Welcome to the Vietnamese podcast. Today I have Tom Le on. I've been following Tom Le for quite a while now. Tom has been highlighting military, Vietnamese American military folks throughout the history of the last perhaps 50 years, even more. There are some very interesting things about the people that Tom has highlighted. All of them have been, you know, high-ranking, have done a lot for the Vietnamese American military community. Not all have I been on board with in terms of what they've done, but for the most part, Tom, you've done a great job. But there is a few things that we will be talking to you about today, Tom. Your work in Vietnam and your identity, the feelings that you've had growing up. So welcome to the Vietnamese podcast.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks for having me on the show. Excited to be here.
So am I. I've waited for a few months to sit and talk to you. We could start at a lot of different places. And I think the first place would probably be West Point. You know, what made you decide to join the military academy?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't something that was in the books at all. I never actually intended on joining the military to begin with at an early age. I think it was just a matter of circumstance and a matter of exposure. So I grew up in a single parent household, first generation to go to high school, go to college. So there wasn't a lot of kind of navigation or mentorship in the way that I should proceed with my education. So I ended up going to the University of Minnesota after high school. I did about a year there and I got to kind of explore what that experience was like. Unfortunately, I didn't do so well there. And I kind of learned about life and finances and struggled academically. And I actually ended up moving back from the University of Minnesota to St. Cloud, where my folks reside. And I end up going to a community college.
I did not know that. I didn't even know you could rebound from that kind of failure and go to West Point.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
It's incredible. I mean, I essentially dropped out of University of Minnesota as a result of academics, went to a community college for about a semester. And then at that time, I was working at a hardware store and a buddy had just come back from a deployment. Wow. And he had told me about his experience and he had told me about his drive and his purpose. And it was something that at that time in my life really aligned with something I was looking for, which was, you know, the ability to escape, which was to explore, travel, to go out and see what experiences there are, but also to be able to have a purpose, to have a mission and to be focused, and also to be around other people that were also very driven. And so he told me about the experience. It was something that interested me and actually went to the recruiting station and I enlisted as a combat medic for that time period. And so when I was going through basic training and I was going through AIT to learn my trade, and a West Point admissions officer actually came through and actually told our cohort about the service academy. And that was something that had interested me because while I was still interested in the military, I was also still interested in receiving an education. And I was also interested in potentially going to medical school to becoming a doctor. And I realized that West Point can offer all those things. And so I weighed my options. I looked at ROTC, West Point, and then OCS, which are the three different ways to commission. I finished AIT. I went back to Minnesota because I was in the Minnesota National Guard. I went to a third college, St. Cloud State University, to continue to improve my academics. And then from there, I applied for West Point, and I received an appointment that following year and started from in the summer of 2012.
the journeys that we take in life. Fascinating. Because, you know, I mean, there's a lot of us that probably think, you know, you have to get straight A's, you get that congressman or that senator to endorse, you know, the letter. You got to get, like, you know, a lot of activities on your resume, and then you apply at high school, and that is like an uphill battle. That's
100%.
Very, very difficult to do. I mean, arguably, probably easier. I mean, harder than, you know, these Ivy League schools. But to turn your life around, failing out of community college is such a huge, you know, thing to overcome.
Yeah. I mean, going into West Point, I think my profile was pretty unconventional. I mean, three different academic institutions. Prior service soldier. I came in when I was about 21, where most of the other students were 18. And so I think falling forward many times really allowed me to be able to get the data points and the experience to lock in and understand, like, what I need to do to succeed. So once I got in, like, all I had to do was focus on was, like, finishing. And, you know, the 4 years at West Point, everything was new. Again, like, someone who just didn't have any exposure to the military, just what West Point was expected. I mean, my family, they didn't even know what West Point was until they came to my graduation. And that was the only time. So none of us knew what was expected. And for me, I was just like, hey, I got in. I guess I need to finish. Otherwise, I have to go back to my life. So I need to make this right. And this is my last shot. So yeah, the 4 years flew by, and I think really instilled a lot of the core values that I have today. It really reinforced the identity that I hope to develop, achieve, and really has opened up the doors in terms of mentorship and just the focus that I needed within my career. And I think that was the starting point of where everything began for me.
You know, the moral of this story really is you can go so far down in terms of achievement, flunking out of community college because of academics, and still pull the nose of that plane right up and really take it to such high limits, you know. And I think that I'm going to definitely use this story when I'm talking to my children as they're as they're growing up, because my brother and I had the same journey. We did not have good models and guidance, you know, and through no fault of my parents, they just didn't have it. They were focused on religious activity, wanting us to become priests. So by the time we got recruited into the Marine Corps as enlisted soldiers and enlisted Marines, we had my brother is like a 2.3 GPA, you know, coming out of high school, just directionless. And he gets there, gets straight A's in community college, and then gets to USC and go to art school, and then runs a whole company of visual effects in Vietnam for many, many years. Mm. Still does. Became a, you know, high functioning member of society due to our changes. And so this military life does have its massive advantages once you lock in, as you say. So I'm just really blown away by your journey. It's totally unexpected.
Yeah, I think one other thing to touch on is that, like, I think for immigrant parents that come over, they want the best for their kids and to succeed. But I also think that there's, like, this assumption that if they just, you know, provide for them and put a roof over their head, that the kids, the assumption is that they will automatically succeed and that they will know what to do from an education standpoint. When in fact, like, a lot of it is, a lot of kids, they just need, like, that person to be there for them, right? Like, the mentorship aspect is often neglected, but often it's very important for the kid to understand what direction they need to go. And I think a lot of us feel that because we have that pressure to succeed, but we don't always have the tools or the resources to be able to do it. And so, you know, that's something that I hope that a lot of viewers and listeners can resonate that are coming from similar households or backgrounds. It's like it's the assumption's there, but I think we can do so much more to improve that.
Now I'm beginning to understand why you post so much about these military folks, Vietnamese Americans, because we share the same viewpoints about why we highlight these people, because really in highlighting these people that have made it so far in the military, we are in our own way inspiring ourselves, you and I, but we're just, you know, you're highlighting more military. I highlight the whole gamut of Vietnamese people around the world. And I do that because I want to inspire myself. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm doing this really for myself because I look at I marvel at what the Vietnamese, and it could be anything. If you were born a Mexican, if you're born, mm-hmm. you know, a Salvadorian, or if you're born a Filipino, we'll probably end up, you know, we're just highlighting the things that are close to our identity. Sure. Happens to be Vietnamese, but I'm, you know, have love and respect for everybody. And just happens to be that we're Vietnamese, but, you know, you're focusing very much on the military folks. And it inspires our journey to do better every day. 100%. Just watching these people.
You hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's something that's very tangible. These people are all people that we can connect to because they resemble our parents. They resemble people within our community, our siblings. And so if I read about this story, like I can connect with this person because I can see myself in them. And we all love a great underdog story.
Yeah.
That's why we're rooting for them and we want them to win. And we see ourselves as underdogs as well. And so if they can do it, that should give us the motivation that we can do it too. And that's ultimately the goal, is like, how do we continue to inspire the next generation so that they have that? I mean, again, it's a story. It's a journey. It's the lessons learned, but those things can transcend like generations. Yeah. And through any type of platform. So yeah, I think what we're doing really aligns with that goal.
Yeah. I don't know if we you and I went over the major points of interest that I have in your work and your life. I'm just going to say it again, just so I can reiterate with the audience that's listening. Your work with former and current military Vietnamese that we just talked about, highlighting their lives. Your work at the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, so important. And the intersection of identity, politics, military, and activism, and highlighting all of these stories are also wonderful things. We come from the same but very different. You know, I got out of the military in 96, end of 96. My contract was supposed to end in 97, but I didn't take leave for a while. So I got out early, got to get out early. So I did my 4 years, got out of 97. So you are probably a few years younger than I am. And so I say this because our time away from the military gives us some breathing room and gives us some space. I can say things and be very public about certain things, but that's not why we're here. We're not here to kind of debate like the differences and everything. I'm here to ask you to get some perspective about the current state. I can't imagine that you agree 100% on what, because I've read your posts. There are guys that I don't agree with. There's, you know, things in the world of the military today that I can only imagine our leaders feeling like they have their arm twisted, whether that's FBI, CIA, DEA, up and down the military branches. How do you feel about seeing what's happening in the world of the ranks that we come from?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very like difficult thing to navigate because of just the optics that are involved and the politics. And of course, if you're like an active serving member or someone that works for the government, Like there are some things that, some implications that people have to consider carefully when they speak within their position. And so I think like for people that are out, of course, like I think it's easier to be able to communicate more freely without worrying about like the backlash or how it could affect your profession or your career or even your image. But I think for folks that are within, they have to tread more carefully. And I think for me, how I'm looking at this is that we have an important message that we're trying to share with our audience. And I think we are trying to be stewards to do it in a way that still gets to the end goal or the end audience without potentially tarnishing like the larger institution. And I know I'm kind of like speaking broadly and kind of like in hypotheticals, but it's just a really precarious situation that requires like careful attention in how you do it. Because I use like a military reference. It's like you can receive an order from a commander and you need to carry out that mission. And sometimes you or your soldiers may not always agree with it, but how do you communicate that message, that order to them, so that it still resonates and so that they're still motivated to get the mission done? Like, we're going to get the mission done, but we're going to find a way that does it in a way that is ethical, moral, legal. And again, like, sometimes there's things that are being done behind the scenes that we may not always be privy to, but within the position that we're in, we have to be able to do our best to be able to ensure that gets communicated. So whenever I receive an order, you know, I own it, but I have to be able to do it in a way that it's going to take care of my soldiers at the same time. And we're going to get that done. So I think about that in the same way now, like on the outside, there's still a mission that needs to be done. It needs to be communicated effectively and professionally, but there's a way to do it.
I'm guilty of not giving full context to certain things. I'm going to lay into Humgao. I'm going to do it as most respectful to you as possible because I don't have respect for what he said and did. So just to paint a background picture for my, you know, the audience is, you know, Humgao made a joke about, you know, wearing a hood from the KKK and was on, I can't remember what show he was on. Was it Tucker or one of these shows? And he said, you know, give me the hood and you don't have to put the circles in the eyes. Just cut me a slit, you know, just to talk about his Asian eyes. I did a whole clip on that on my Instagram and all my, you know, socials. And I just laid into it. I said, you know, that's like, what kind of joke, what kind of sick, perverse joke is that? And, you know, that's my point of view and I'm allowed to have it. But what I did not think is how many Vietnamese people, Vietnamese American people think that that's okay, that joke was okay. And these are not like Vietnamese people like coming straight from Vietnam and has been here for like 10, 15 years. These are like people who are probably born here like us, who've been here forever. And like they come from the conservative side and, you know, like get off your, you know, it's just a joke, like get over it. I found that to be so, it did not sit well with me with the history of the KKK.
Yeah.
How could we, I'm a big proponent of comedy, like say what you want to say, right? We should all, it's America. We should be allowed to say and utilize our free speech. But coming from Humgao at this time, it still bothers me to no end. And I just wanted to hear, cause you've highlighted him and, you know, when he was running for senator out of Virginia, I was, you know, I asked him to come on the podcast and we were so close to it. I talked to his people and And I don't know what I would have said had he come on the podcast, because, you know, once you come on the podcast, it's like, oh, all right, we're friends. But now it's just, it was so heartbroken. I was so heartbroken to see that.
I feel you on that. I feel the same way, Kenneth. I think making a joke in this politically divisive environment right now at the expense of your own people, I think is just bad tastes.
Yeah.
And I think, again, like, he has a responsibility to be a good steward of communicating on the community's behalf. But, you know, I understand objectively, like, for him to be able to do what he needs to do and succeed in the role that he's at, there are things that he's doing, and that doesn't mean that I agree with it. Objectively, I understand, like, that's the path that he has accepted and that he's willing to do, and he has to accept the consequences of, you know, his behaviors. But that's not why I highlighted him. I highlighted him because I think about, again, just like the representation of being able to be a Vietnamese American and be the acting secretary of the Navy is something that hasn't done before. Yeah, it's incredible for the community. Massive. And that's something that's still worth highlighting and sharing. Yeah. And I spoke to another friend about this, but I just want to highlight Vietnamese excellence without the politics. It's like, let's talk about people's achievements. Let's talk about what they're capable of. And of course, everyone has their shortcomings, and that's something that we all carry. But it doesn't mean that, like, I don't give him a pass on what he did. That's what I'm also saying too. It's like, even though I shared it, even though I'm highlighting his profile, it doesn't mean that I agree with all of his politics either. But I hope that within the audience that we do have, that it can kind of continue to inspire people to elevate and even use his experience as like a lesson.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Yeah, he didn't need to do that. You know, he's gotten so far. I remember in the halls and in the offices of, you know, these headquarters that you walk through, the S1s, the S2s, the S3s, the different offices, you always see pictures of, you know, especially being a Marine, you see, you know, our granddaddy, we're you know, is the Secretary of the Navy. That's our grandfather in the Marines, right? That's who we answer to. It's the Commandant of the Marine Corps, and then the Secretary of the Navy is our Commandant's boss, and then there's the President. And now we have this Vietnamese American guy
who
is, you know, that's like a god to an enlisted man like me that was coming up. It's incredible. What an incredible achievement, right? Regardless of what, so he didn't have to do that. That's all I'm saying. He just didn't have to do that.
The decorum, it was totally out of pocket. Yeah.
Yeah. You didn't have to do it. And I talked to other military officers that are Vietnamese who are now retired, and, you know, the old guys are like, man, that's a bad look.
You know, it's a missed opportunity. That's how I see it. You know, like, you have this platform now, and you have the ability to shift perceptions and bias. Like, even on that podcast, like, I'm sure there's a total, completely different audience that is watching that, and he has that opportunity to shift their perception of the Vietnamese people. And so it could have been, it's, again, just a missed opportunity.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. But I'm glad we got to talk about him, and, you know, I hope that we all learn from that. Yeah. So you are part of this Defense POW MIA accounting agency, and I think that's a really big, big deal. And I'll tell you why I think it's something that's really important to talk about, not just because it's who you are and what you've done, but this idea of, you know, I think a lot of people in the Vietnamese communities throughout the U.S. diaspora look at the governments of Vietnam and the U.S. As strategic, and two bodies of governments having to work with each other and really find ways to bring soldiers, POWs, MIAs back to the U.S. is a big thing. But I think one thing that is not talked about too often is really how closely the governments work together. And I wanted to ask you about that. You know, you being on the inside of it, it seems like the work that you and your Vietnamese counterparts is such a harmonic dance, and it seems to kind of like been working out. I mean, from what I'm seeing on the outside, like, we have to roll our sleeves up. We have to find these bodies. We have to find these stories and bring them back to their families. Can you tell me a little bit about the cooperation on the other side?
Yeah. So the last year and a half, I've been in Hanoi, Vietnam, at the detachment that's there. And we have detachments all over the world. And then the headquarters is based in Hawaii and in DC. So the detachment is essentially forward deployed. And what we do is we do mission control, which means we support all of the deployed service members and civilians that come from Hawaii and the rest of the world to locate and search for the remains of fallen U.S. soldiers from previous conflict, in this case, Vietnam. And the work that we've been doing over there, it's so fascinating. Even to this day, like, I still, like, it's crazy to explain to people the work that we do and also learning about the history. Well, but we've been in Vietnam for over 50 years, even before the war ended, looking for, again, POWs, MIAs, of U.S. soldiers. And after the war, you know, this priority to no soldier left behind, that has always been like a paramount thing. And I think to see two countries as adversaries in the past and now coming together as allies, that is now part of a comprehensive strategic partnership. Over 50 years is something that it's like a lesson in itself, right? Mm. Like, a lot of countries that are at battle with one another, and the United States and Vietnam kind of demonstrating that it is possible to find, you know, like this friendship, this alliance, this partnership, but then also to do something that is completely humanitarian with really, like, there's no, like, financial gain for the United States to do something like this, right? Like, there's very few countries actually in the world that actually go out and look for their fallen soldiers from, like, let alone like 10, 15 years. This is like 50. We're still looking for soldiers from World War II. So it's an incredible thing, and it's an incredibly difficult thing to do. So I want to say is that the humanitarian work that we do out in Vietnam is the cornerstone of the partnership that we have today. So the office, our Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency office in Vietnam was created in 1991, 4 years before the normalization of relations between both countries, which means the office was there before the embassy was even there. Right? There's no ambassador there. The work that they were doing in terms of excavations, it was just like either unilateral or bilateral between the two countries. And so having that as the foundation to be able to begin, like, negotiations, diplomacy.
Started there.
It started right there. And it continues to be a cornerstone of negotiation between two countries to further different priorities, whether it is the Agent Orange, like them kind of rehabilitating those different areas, them looking for their own martyrs, and all the other work that we're doing as partners. So I look at that as, like, if there's no DPAA, it's hard to say, like, looking back from now, but, like, what would our relationship be without that?
So DPAA has been there What year was DPAA's office first, or whatever that iteration looked like? What year?
1991, but they started back before, in 1974.
Okay, so yeah, you have an officer. There was an officer in 1974. So you, like, we think about like 1996 as like Clinton and the Johns, right? John McCain. Yep. And they all go in, and I was thinking to myself, okay, then in 96, we drop an office in there, right? No. It starts much earlier.
Yes.
And records were kept much earlier. So by the time Bill Clinton is going in there to really sit down and negotiate, we got numbers and we have data way.
And allies.
Allies.
Right?
Inside, yeah.
Right. Like allies in terms of like, after the war, like there had to have been some point where there's some type of interaction. You building trust, you building like allies in terms of people that you can communicate to, and like that all had to have been the groundwork before the embassy was even able to like, you know, build, and the ambassador like stepping in. So I think that the groundwork there is really important to highlight.
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. Some things will never be replicated by AI. The fragrance of fish sauce hitting a hot pan, the sound of your grandmother's voice telling a story only she knows, the feeling of a family recipe passed down through generations that are imperfect, alive, and completely real. Red Boat Fish Sauce has been a proud sponsor of the Vietnamese podcast for years because, like us, they believe in authenticity you can taste. And together we're bringing you the Viet Story Bank, a recording service built on that same belief. Your stories matter. Your family's memories, your lived experiences, your history. These deserve to be preserved exactly as they are. Untouched, unfiltered, they're human. So don't wait for the right moment. Learn more about the Viet Story Bank through the link in our show notes and pick up a bottle of fish sauce at H-Mart, 99 Ranch, or redboatfishsauce.com.
How often and how difficult, I mean, I know it's very difficult, but how often do you actually have new details about service members that that we find?
New details, I think, is probably less common. But in terms of us finding possible osseous material, which is anything that is like DNA or genetically linked to the individual, it's still happening. Like,
and
we just had
osseous is what, bones?
Bone, yeah, bone material. But you know, we can also find like teeth. We can find identification media such as like dog tags, wallets, which is what we've done. Like my time there across, you know, four or five JFAs, joint field activities, in each one, we have found possible osseous material or some type of identification media. And at this point in time where we're at, it's the hardest cases left. Mm-hmm. Like everything that was like easy to find was immediately after the war. 50 years later, what remains is like the cases that are in the most isolated parts of Vietnam, either in the jungle, in the mountains, or even in the ocean. And the exciting part about the job is that like we travel to all parts of Vietnam and in the elements. So you can see a lot of different aspects, and you really can engage with the local people at that part of Vietnam to be able to further like triangulate where these individuals are.
Are you still on active duty?
No, I got out of active duty in 2021. So for the last 5 years, I've been a civilian.
DOD?
DOD civilian. Mm.
What is the perception that you've have since you've been on the ground in Vietnam, and how has that sort of informed your own identity now that you're dealing with all these people from inside of Vietnam?
Great question, Ken. I've told you that my life is all about like falling forward and figuring it out. And never would I have imagined myself being in a position like this in this agency doing what I do. I've actually always had a dream, weirdly, to go back to Vietnam. Not go back, actually go to Vietnam. Because I've actually never...
States, right?
I was born in the States. But go to Vietnam and to live and work there for some time to better understand my roots and my heritage. And this is, again, after I developed a deep appreciation for that. And so the opportunity came up and I applied for a language specialist role, which is like becoming like the mouthpiece and the interface, or I actually say the bridge between two countries. So I applied for this role. And again, like growing up in the United States, I didn't even speak Vietnamese. Not even like, I mean, just probably to my mom. But outside of that, it was like full English, especially being in the Midwest. I did not have a lot of exposure. So I ended up like hiring a tutor to learn Vietnamese at a like business proficiency level. And it wasn't even like Southern dialect. It was like Northern dialect. So completely outside of my comfort zone, did what I need to do to prepare for the requirements of the position. And then again, to receive the acceptance of the position and then to move my family over to Vietnam. At the time, my wife and I, we just quit our jobs. We sold our house. We had a 6-month infant, and we just moved. And to go to a place that was actually very foreign but familiar at the same time was a ride of a lifetime. I felt like that last year and a half, it felt so long because of just how much we've done. But I felt like I was... something, it was just such a unique opportunity. Like, given my experience as being a Vietnamese American veteran and officer in the United States Army, and then now being able to go to Vietnam, become a bridge for the United States and Vietnam to look for U.S. service members that passed away during the Vietnam War. And they were the very reason why my folks were even in America to begin with. It's a full circle moment, and I just felt incredibly honored and proud to do the work and to be that individual, to be the bridge between two countries, two worlds, professionally and personally. I think it was just awesome.
When did you get back here?
Like less than, like 3 weeks ago.
From Vietnam?
From Vietnam.
And what was the total amount of time that you spent in Vietnam?
About a year and a half.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
That's a long time. And in terms of language proficiency, did you obviously get a lot better to the point where you're, you know, really being able to convey your innermost thoughts and be able to...
I think enough. Like, I would say, like, I'm not going to try to sugarcoat it. I think I'm pretty... good conversationally. I think I picked up on a lot of like technical terms that are specific to the work that we do. But I'd say I'm nowhere near like academic fluency. But it being there within the environment definitely allowed me to just go deeper and then understand more of the like the local semantics and jargon that they use.
How much more work do we have there in that department?
We have 1,566 individuals that we're still looking for.
Okay, but let me stop you real quick. 1,566. But do we ever close that out and say, you know what, out of the 1,500 cases, we're probably never going to see 1,400 of these. These 166, maybe we have leads to it, But the other 1,400, like, that's done. Is there ever that kind of closure? Or do we just keep digging and, you know, pardon the pun, but keep digging for those 1,566 names?
Yeah, I mean, I think at some point, after so much time has elapsed, there's just no more work to do. But I think from a scientific standpoint, the work that we do is very, it's archaeology and it's forensics. And so what they do when they go to these sites is they literally turn over every single rock and stone, and they will carve out every single unit 1 meter by 1 meter, like you see in like Jurassic Park. And they will excavate that entire area to a point where, from an archaeological standpoint, they're like, there's literally nothing here. And they'll do that in the ocean as well. You'll do grid by grid by grid, going down to like, you know, 100 feet. And once you've done that, then yes, if you don't find anything, then you can say, we've done everything that we could have done and that we can't recover them.
And how many cases has that happened where we're like, we can't go further?
I don't have that number off the top of my head, but I do understand that as long as we still continue to find individuals, that we continue the mission. And right now, the window that we're experiencing is we're at a point where the witness population, they're like aging and their memory is just not good anymore like it used to be, or they're passing away. So part of it is like trying to do as many like interviews as much as possible and trying to document and archive as much as possible. The other aspect is the landscape is changing. So there's development. The country is growing at a rapid pace. You're starting to see more infrastructure being built over these sites that are preventing people, preventing our teams from being able to get into there. A dam could be created over it, and then you can't do anything, right?
Yeah.
And then the last part is just like the soil erosion and turnover. There's just so much acidity within the soil that it degrades the bone and the osseous material. So we're really fighting against time and trying to use the current technology that we have today and just trying to use our manpower to be able to find what we can.
What's next for you now that you're back in the US?
Yeah. So I transferred to the headquarters office in Hawaii as a research analyst. And a lot more of my work is going to be into like diving into the historicals and to be able to, again, like data drives decisions. So we create the case, we try to find as many leads as possible, and then that prompts the teams to actually go out there and investigate and then excavate. So the crazy thing is like the crossover is, it's like a lot of the work that I'm kind of doing on the side, which yeah. is just like naturally just like researching these individuals. And I have a natural interest in this. And so it's just, again, worlds collide.
So you're right now calling from Houston, but you are going to be stationed in Hawaii.
Yes. Yep.
And in like Kaneohe Bay, is that like, where are you at?
So we'll be at Joint Base Pearl Harbor, Hickam. So we'll be just outside Honolulu.
Man, you're going from one duty station to the next duty station.
It doesn't stop.
Just amazing duty stations, man. It's crazy. And how long are you going to be in Hawaii for?
So for Hawaii, it doesn't have a backstop. So it's just, I guess, until the next chapter begins.
It's fantastic. And you'll be cranking out the content that you've been doing with the Vietnamese. Yeah.
Yeah.
You ever think of starting a podcast?
It's funny you mentioned that. This is actually the first time I've been in the hot seat on the receiving end. So I actually do have a podcast. I started a podcast called long gray lessons back in 2017. And it was a time where actually there wasn't like a ton of podcasting that was happening. And I was just inspired by listening to all my classmates' stories. And that's what created, formulated like long gray lessons, the long gray line, like lessons learned from their time in the military. And again, I think I have this fascination behind people and people's stories and how they got to where they're at. And again, what you said is like, selfishly, I need this hope and this inspiration to push myself to be able to get to that point. And I do it by listening to them. And similarly, like, they also have the opportunity to reflect on their own experience. And hopefully they can save the heartache for anyone else that is trying to do the same thing by sharing their stories.
So I did see long gray lessons on your feed. The one time that, I mean, I probably didn't get far down enough. You were interviewing a former classmate from Afghanistan, and I was going to ask you that. I didn't realize that was your own podcast. I should have dug a lot deeper, because, you know, it was like your feed has so many different posts, but that was the one long gray lesson podcast post that I saw. So I didn't think much of it. I was like, oh, maybe you were being,
Fair enough.
But there's so much, there's so much to research about you that, and so are you continuing that podcast?
It's been a while since I've been able to sit with another individual. I like doing them face to face. So I actually did another interview last year with a classmate out in Da Nang. And but in terms of like regularly, I haven't kept it up. So, and that's why I kind of like pivoted to this. Part of it is like logistically, it's very taxing, as you know, especially the ones that are in person. And I used to be a one-man show to do all the camera equipment, the recording, and the actual hosting. But yes, pivoting over to the actual stories itself, I think achieves the same end state and allows me to just pump up more stories a lot quicker.
Oh my God, you know how many people send me your stories? I'm like, oh my God, who's this Tom kid? Who's this guy? Like, you know, everybody's sending me these like links to all these military. And I'm like, the way you format it, the way you, your graphics and the way, you know, I'm like, oh, it's coming from Tom again, you know.
I'm humbled.
It's awesome. I know a lot. I've had so many people send me your links. You know, you gotta get this guy on. I'm like, well, let me get to the source. Let me get to Tom first, and then, you know, let's see if he knows any of these people. Because it takes a lot of work to like reach out to everybody and coordinate that. I mean, but. That's why I asked if you had a podcast, because I'm like, that would be perfect if you handled all the military folks that, and I've had a few of the guys on, but, you know, some of these people are like just amazing.
Of course.
Say again?
I was saying, of course, like they have incredible stories, but like you said, like it takes a lot of work to be able to coordinate too. So.
Yeah. There's so much work that, It's crazy. There is a Nguyen Ngoc Hung, I think that was the person that you met. I wanted to start the podcast with this story, but I don't have the discipline to like stick to one. There's just so much interesting facts going on with you. But this is one of the things that I was going to start with. But so this idea of two governments that used to be at war with each other. Nguyen Ngoc Hung is somebody that is from the Vietnamese side, Vietnamese national, that you met in the halls of West Point. Is that right? Did I get that story right?
That's right. When I was a firstie. Yeah.
Can you tell me about like Vietnamese? And I don't think he's the first one. I think he's... There was one back in 74, 73. But let's talk about this person, because you actually, it's a modern story that you actually met him at West Point. And but he's not American. He's not a Vietnamese American like us. He's an actual Vietnamese national from Vietnam. How did he end up there? How did you meet him? What was the circumstances of you meeting him again? Can you give me the download?
Yeah, so the story behind him is that he is a Vietnamese national within the Ministry of National Defense. And I believe he is probably like an 05, 06 now within the Vietnamese army. And he was actually in the States doing his senior leadership training, I think at like CGSC or one of the other military schools that they have for senior officers. And that cohort actually was comprised of a bunch of other international military officers. And part of that curriculum is actually traveling to different duty stations and seeing how they operate. So they were just at West Point for 1 or 2 days to see how West Point operates. And so like, it was kind of weird, like for me, again, this is at a time where I was like extremely fascinated with just like Vietnamese military, Vietnamese officers. And what I mean by that is like Vietnamese American. So seeing a actual Vietnamese national within the military at roaming the halls of West Point, I was just like, this guy is, what is he doing here? So as a senior, I was like, hey, I would love to strike up a conversation with this guy, talk to him, learn more about his background, ask him, why is he here? How did he end up here? And we stayed in touch. That was 10 years ago. And fast forward like to last year, during a 4th of July party hosted by the U.S. Embassy in Vietnam, in Hanoi. He's back in Vietnam working, and he was at the same event. And I recognized him instantly because he just like didn't age, and he recognized me. And this time he was the one that was questioning me. He's like, what are you doing in Vietnam? Why are you here? And I explained the work that I was doing. And I think that interaction again is like a testament of how far our two countries have come, and kind of demonstrating that it's no, like, we're no longer adversaries. What people think about like these two countries today, it's like people do, but today's generation, they don't think about the war like our parents or our grandparents do. They think about like the future. Like, what are we doing today? How are we like trying to improve our people's environment? What do we think about the economy? What do we think about education? And so I think between that interaction between us, like 10 years later, and us kind of like having that friendship and that bond, and there's nothing that we're trying to gain from one another other than just appreciation for the work that we do. I think that is like a testament, again, of just like how far two countries have come.
I feel like a backward ass person even talking about how different we are as Vietnamese Americans and a Vietnamese national. I feel like I'm so like in the dark ages still, if I'm like talking about, you know what I mean? When I think about the story that you have with him, with Nguyen Ngoc Hưng, I think about, that's like, you're living in the future, but it's not really the future. It's like here, we're like, there is a Vietnamese national that was sent from Vietnam's military inside to West Point. So whatever kind of misconceptions we have, I mean, it's really changed my views about, oh my God, you know, we're three stripes and, you know, yellow flag and, you know, oh my God, I look at the red flag and I'm so allergic. Oh my God, it's, you know, and I'm just speaking for a lot of people that I know, you know, that fair. That's not how I operate, you know, but when I look up at your story and Nguyen Ngoc Hưng's story, and you think about like this clearance of having a Vietnamese national 10 years ago at West Point, that collaboration between the two governments, they're like, these people like in the governments are seeing things way beyond where we as civilian people see it. And you, as a military person who got to experience that at West Point, it changes and alters your view of the relations between two countries today. Yeah. And that's why I do the work that I do too, is because we have to shift this perspective. We're no longer we are no longer even close to being adversaries. We're working so close that we even have some of their nationals at our, the hallowed halls of West Point. This is such a massive deal for people who don't understand, wait a minute. And that's only a personal story that we know because of you, right? But how many other times did Vietnam send their military people to come and study at the Naval Academy, tour around Ivy League schools? Because I've heard stories of this, firsthand accounts of the Vietnamese government coming to America, going into the hallowed halls of the Ivy League or Naval Academy, now West Point.
Yeah.
This has been going on since the 70s.
Yeah, 1971 to be exact, at least for West Point. I mean, Hung, he was not a graduate. He was just a visitor. But Mr. Tham Minh Pham, he was the first Vietnamese national to attend West Point, graduate from West Point, went back to West Point. Went back to Vietnam right before the end of the war. And then became a prisoner of war, came back to the United States. He was the first and last one. And so when I came back to West Point as staff, as an admissions officer. So I oversaw admissions for the entire Southeast region. And looking at applicant files, my goal was actually to get the second Vietnamese national to attend West Point. So I worked pretty closely with our admissions team to be able to identify, someone that could pass all the requirements for the academy. And then when I was in Vietnam last year, up until last month, I was working with the U.S. Embassy to, again, identify an individual that could attend the academy. Unfortunately, no one this year was able to pass requirements for at least West Point, but there has been one Air Force Academy graduate. He graduated in 2024. So he's actually in Vietnam right now. I'm connected with him. And then there's a second Vietnamese national that's currently at the Air Force Academy. And then I think there's been one at the Naval Academy, and as well as one at the Coast Guard Academy. And that's Vietnam voluntarily sending their folks over there to learn from these institutions this curriculum, because they want to, again, they call this the premier leadership of premier leadership institution within the world. So they want to be able to bring this back, these leaders back, so that they can modernize and innovate and change their own workforce.
This is mind-blowing to me, because I'm always saying on the podcast, I'm always saying that the progress of Vietnam's government and what they've achieved is way ahead of what we as civilians know. And today I get to hear it. I get to hear it from you saying that, wait, Vietnam is sending their Vietnamese, their national, their own citizens into the Naval Academy, the Air Force Academy, the West Point, the Military Academy, the Coast Guard Academy. They've been in all four branches. Why would a communist country, send leaders into the military academies of the United States? This is absolutely amazing information, because for all of us that were hoping, and maybe I might be naive and getting overexcited about this, small detail, but it's significant because, if we're operating on this whole, the Constitution of America, we're operating on the principles of this great land, and, Vietnamese nationals are being sent over to study, and then they're being brought back to operate within the, they're probably sending their people over to Europe as well. Why not? Okay. Right.
Yeah. They are.
And then bringing them back and incorporating them into the military back in Vietnam. So this is this is huge news. This is a big thing to me.
Do you think it's a good thing?
I think it's a fantastic thing. I think it's, how can it be a bad thing?
Right.
Right. Tom, that's how true. Could, I mean, why would you ask me that? Do you think it's a good thing?
100% agree. I do. Again, it's all about like understanding what the appetite is. And I mean, if, and also like, are they being progressive in terms of like how they want to modernize? Right. And a lot of it is like how you think. So if they were oppressive in nature, they wouldn't even allow these guys out at all.
Totally. That's right? It. If they were oppressive in nature, it would not happen. That's like Putin sending his guys into, and why would the U.S. allow any Russian KGB or, you know, operatives to go into our, yeah. Unless the United States has a vision too. They're just like, oh, well, why don't we educate these guys, send them back home and, you know, so they can kind of operate the same way we do, which is a, it's going to be a win-win no matter what. Like, agreed. We're not going to teach you strategy that is so top secret that, you know, you're going to take back to Vietnam or to Russia and do some crazy stuff. This is like all principles, I think, of fairness, equality, things that we aspire to in the United States traditionally.
And these guys, they're young people that are going to be the next generation of leaders. So if they have this new perspective and new way of looking at how they're going to operate, they're going to hopefully be able to influence their formations. And that's where the change occurs.
It's beautiful. It's so, you know, amazing. I would love to, you know, I tell this to all my guests. I never get enough of any of our guests because it's just fascinating. I never got to really talk to you about your ideas about Afghanistan because, you know, you sit with your classmate and the recent turning people back to sending them back to Afghanistan, you know, with this current administration, is mind-boggling to me. I don't know how much of it is true and how much of it is being actively pursued, but there's those topics that I would love for you to come back back on the podcast when you resettle in, you know, in Hawaii. And yeah. I, you know, I'll probably take my kids by the end of the year to head out to Hawaii.
We could do it in person, Ken.
Yeah, would love that. Tom, thank you so much. You know, appreciate everything that you do and continue. I hope that you continue to do it. And, you know, you're really highlighting the best of our people to the world. And, you know, you can't imagine how many people are reading this, you know, not just the U.S. diaspora, but all over the world. There's people in Europe and I'm sure South America with Vietnamese descent, Vietnamese blood that are reading it going, wow, this is pretty fascinating stuff.
Yeah. Thanks again for the opportunity to be on the show, Ken. And again, I just want to get across is like these stories, they're just ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And we all see a little bit of ourselves in these individuals. And I hope that it can inspire yourself to be able to be that change that you want to see. So
thanks, Tom. I appreciate you.
Thanks, Ken.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.